My name is Shubh Saran, and this is a podcast series where I explore the life of musicians on and off stage. I'm making this series to ask what it means to be a musician today in the hopes that I can better understand what we do and why we choose to do it. Adam Neely definitely needs no introduction, especially if you're familiar with my work over the past couple of years. If you're a musician or are just interested in prog jazz fusion-y music, and you've at some point in your life been on YouTube, then you know who Adam is. He's not only someone I've come to work with in many different bands, but he's also a very close friend. And in the last few years, we've become a part of an incredible and really special community of musicians in New York. He's a professional bass player and composer. He has an awesome band with drummer Sean Crowder called Sungazer, and I'll actually be playing guitar with them on tour this September. And he's also a professional YouTuber with a channel that currently has 1.59 million subscribers. Today, I'm going to talk to him about how that happened and where it all started. The unique thing about releasing content online consistently and regularly is that not only does it crystallize your artwork on a platform for everyone to see, but it also traces the evolution of that artwork going back in time to the very first thing you ever released. And for Adam, that very first thing he released is a cover of The Maple Leaf Rag from February 4th, 2006, 16 years ago. He's 17 years old in high school, living at home just outside of Washington, D.C.
I was really into tapping. That was the hot new thing back when I was in high school.
This was around the time that a lot of guitarists and bassists like Adam and I discovered people like Adam Fullera or Andy McKee, who released his viral tapping song Drifting around this time. Playing the guitar kind of like a piano where you're using both hands to tap notes on the fretboard.
There is a Polish guitarist by the name of Adam Fullera, who at the time I was really into. You know, I was checking out a lot of Greg Howe, I believe is his name, his stuff with Chapman's Stick, and I really was excited about it. Like, this was the thing that I felt was really my identity. I really wanted to be the seven-string bass tapping guy.
So as a teenager, locked in his room, spending months and months learning this super complicated arrangement on the bass, Adam posted his first ever YouTube video at a time when YouTube itself was only 1 year old. But aside from posting online, he also posted the video on the forums of MX Tabs, a website where guitarists and bassists of that generation would go on and try to find tab notation for songs that we loved.
I was like, hey, check me out. This is a cool thing. And that was kind of the mindset. It was the same people who post on Instagram do today and TikTok do today. It was just YouTube was new at the time.
This one video posted on a forum would start a pattern of Adam uploading and posting songs and just things he was working on as a teenager. Things like a cover of Chameleon by Herbie Hancock or a version of Donna Lee, the famous and very difficult bebop standard. And while he was doing this and posting to MX Tabs, he started to create a little bit of an early community on his channel, working up to a few hundred subscribers.
There were people who were sharing their videos also, their performances.
And they would all watch each other's work using YouTube as an easy way to share their videos. But if you look at Adam's channel today, you won't find any of those videos, and that's because years later, Adam would look back on his channel and actually delete a lot of those early videos, losing them forever.
I looked back at it at a certain point, and I thought, man, this isn't very good. I'm going to delete them. And for archival purposes, that's devastating. I would have loved to see my evolution on YouTube and as a bass player. We have this kind of thought that the internet is forever, but in a real way, it isn't. And purely for the archival purposes, there's something that we're seeing, especially with social media. It's nice that it's so expedient and so readily available for everything, but you really want to save the things that you do because they can go away. And I'm like very frustrated that there's a large portion of my career in a way that's kind of gone to the ether.
So the first lesson of this episode is save your work. Unlist your videos if you don't want them up, but try not to delete anything. You'll thank yourself in the future. So with a small but pretty solid YouTube channel, Adam graduates high school and heads to the Berklee College of Music in Boston. And while he's at Berklee, he doesn't forget about his YouTube community. He continues to make videos using his webcam on his laptop, but the content starts to change ever so slightly, moving into more bass education and music technique related videos instead of covers of songs.
All right, so this is going to be a lesson talking about polyrhythms in music. Now, in case you don't already know, a polyrhythm...
A lot of it was stuff that I was learning at Berkeley. There are actually a fair number of lessons which I've unlisted, but I might relist them again, where I'm essentially regurgitating things that I was learning in my private bass lessons with Dave Buda. But then there were a lot of other things that I had learned from my high school bass teacher, Pepe Gonzalez, who is an amazing upright bass player in the DC area.
And while he's reteaching concepts he's currently learning himself to his YouTube channel, what he's really doing is laying the foundation for internalizing a lot of the music education he's immersed in. The best way to learn something is to teach it to someone else. And YouTube was, and to a certain degree still is, the best way to do that.
You learn something, and then you try to teach it as a way of internalizing it for yourself. So, you know, at the time I was very much a student, but at the same time I was trying to communicate to other people what I had been learning.
There's three notes in the triplet go over the two notes in the eighth notes.
And this is happening all over YouTube. At this point, YouTube is 4 or 5 years old, and people are just turning on their webcams and simply sharing things they're working on.
We had Playbase Now. Marlo DK was the guy who ran that website, and he would have a collection of all these bass teachers and bass players provide lessons for that website, usually through YouTube videos.
This is a small tutorial about my approach to playing the double thumb technique.
And then there was also, of course, Scott's Bass Lessons.
Hi, this is Scott Devine. You can find my website at scottsbasslessons.com.
Was posting a lot back then. And so we all kind of knew each other and were posting these, like, you know, webcam quality lessons, but in, you know, kind of creating a bass education community around YouTube in those days.
So while Adam is joining the ranks of these very early adopters of YouTube bass education, it's now 2009. And his time at Berkeley comes to an end. He has a degree in music. He's learned all the things that a good Berkeley student should know, including how to play over a Jamie Abersold backing track.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
But now what?
So I graduated Berkeley in 2009, and then I spent a year at my parents' place in D.C., just kind of recalibrating, deciding whether or not I wanted to continue to do music. And I did. And I posted a lot of YouTube videos in that year.
In that year of reflection and introspection about being a musician, which is a musician's number one pastime, he's back in the room he grew up in. The same room he recorded the Maple Leaf Rag video, the same place he started his YouTube channel in. And in this year, he posts a ton of videos to his channel, including videos like minor pentatonic linear sequences, or chord scales in jazz chord constructions, or developing safe left-hand technique on the bass guitar.
So this is going to be a lesson about left-hand technique and how to create a safe and comfortable physical approach to the left hand.
It's a more simple time for YouTube, and especially for Adam's channel. Almost like a diary filled with his musical progress over the last 5 years. He's not worried about the metrics and the growth. He's just sharing things he finds interesting.
There's no content strategy. This is just me trying to share cool artistic things with the world.
And as he's sharing cool artistic things with the world, he continues to internalize some pretty heavy musical concepts. And he's also realizing how much he loves to teach. So in 2010, he moves to New York City to attend graduate school at the Manhattan School of Music. And on the side, he's also teaching guitar and picking up gigs here and there in the city.
You know, I really like teaching. I was teaching beginning guitar lessons at the time, but I really wanted to be teaching bass lessons. But I didn't really have a, you know, musical community to teach bass guitar to in New York City. So I kind of turned to YouTube, which is where I had already developed a community. And yeah, I was just posting all throughout that.
He continues to make videos, as he's also completing his second degree in music, and in 2012, Adam leaves Manhattan School of Music armed with a master's in jazz composition, writing music for a big band, and delving into some pretty hardcore theoretical musical information.
We were going deep into this whole thing. At the time, I barely understood it. I still barely understand it. And I kind of was using YouTube as a means of solidifying other ideas around jazz that I had.
And just as he's always done, He's taking difficult information and synthesizing it into fun and easy to understand bass lesson videos, like this one on shell voicings.
Let's take the same sort of technique that we used in the closed position triad video of creating these voicings by voicing down from a top note. So let's take.
But now that he's out of school, he's a New York musician. And like all New York musicians who came before and who will come after him, it's time to figure out how to make it work in the city. He's gigging, he's writing, he's practicing, he's recording, but he's also developing a signature YouTube style. It's videos still recorded on the webcam on his laptop, but it's now lessons focused on the specifics of bass technique and performance tips. Things he's thinking about all the time because he's now a performing and working bass player. He's still just posting for fun and figuring out the platform, and he's not too concerned about the numbers or the strategy or what it all means, the big picture. He's posting because he simply enjoys posting.
From 2006 to maybe 2014 or 2015, YouTube and social media is nothing. I mean, it's a playground. There's no, it's not professionalized. There's not the same, there's no rigor. There's just, you're throwing whatever is up, whatever goes up there. The reason why I liked doing it, it was a thing to do outside of the real musical things to do, which were to practice, to gig, to record, etc., etc. And this was just kind of a fun side project that I was putting together. And it grew very, very slowly because I didn't put much thought into it. It was just something that I could do that I was excited to do. It was like, oh, this is a fun lesson. Like, it's a way of honing my education skills. It's a way of solidifying my thought processes around music and music education. And it's a fun, small, very small community that is kind of coming along with me. And that really was what it was for a very long time, maybe a total of 10 years. It was just a fun side project that I had going on.
It's times like these in the lives of musicians I find the most inspiring, where you're doing something simply because you enjoy doing it. And even though you're thinking about your career in a larger way, you're working, you're busy, and you have to think about making a living as a musician, something compels you to spend your remaining time working on a project that may not fulfill your present-day needs as a musician, but it gives you a deep sense of purpose, and nothing else matters. And while you're doing the thing that gives your life purpose, you're also unknowingly building something and getting better at that thing, developing a strong future skill set, which will lead you to a place that you can't possibly imagine today.
That's a huge amount of time. It's a decade where YouTube is like this thing that I'm slowly working on. It's there in the background, but it is a fun community that I still, you know, I really look back on those days fondly because of it.
It's 2014, and YouTube has been around for 9 years. And it's changed completely from where it first started. People are being recognized and discovered by large record labels and production companies. YouTube covers of pop songs are exploding. And most importantly, people are going viral using music.
This is around the time that the one and only Justin Bieber is found and discovered. You had people like Mystery Guitar Man and Walk Off the Earth, and like viral music is now like very much a genre. Dirty Loops become super popular. This is, I think, around the time where I discovered, they were called at the time Lewis Cole and Genevieve Artadi, but they eventually became Nowhere. And I was like, oh, that sounds like fun. Maybe I could try and do something like that. And so I started doing, for lack of a better term, viral music stuff on YouTube.
And you'd think someone like Adam would be perfectly positioned for something like that. He already has a following on YouTube. He's been growing his channel for almost a decade at this point, and he's familiar with how the whole thing works. But YouTube has changed so much by this point, more than Adam even realizes.
I had spent so much time just like setting up my webcam and just talking that I had no concept of the production value that would go into something like that. It was almost kind of a wake-up call-ish to learn that you needed to spend a lot more time and care with YouTube videos now because people are spending a lot of time getting things right, getting things viral. And I was just like, no, I'm just going to set up a webcam and talk for 15 minutes or whatever.
So he continues making videos in his regular format, the way he's been doing it all these years, using his webcam and talking into it. But even when he changes his content to match that growing trend of viral music, his attempts don't really work out the way he expects them to.
None of my attempts went anywhere because of that. So one of these attempts, I was like going to try and beatbox and play Billie Jean on my bass guitar, but play the melody and the bass line at the same time. So it was going to be this whole thing. Nobody cared about that. And I spent so much time learning how to do it. And I was like, why don't people like me? And then, you know, I kind of, this was for a long time in 2013, 2014, 2015, I was just kind of like, when I had spare time, I was like, what if I do this viral thing? And nothing, like absolutely nothing hit.
Frustrated and wondering why none of his videos are working, he's still posting lessons like he's always done, while he's mixing in different content trying to land a viral video, which in 2015 is the thing to do on YouTube. I kissed a girl and I liked it. It all changes, however, when Justina Soto, who is an amazing vocalist from our community of musician friends in New York, nudges him towards something a little different.
She was like, hey, you have this YouTube channel. People make a lot of money on YouTube. And like, she showed me this website called Social Blue Book. It might still be up there at the time. But it was a place that valued how much like a social media influencer might be worth if they started working with sponsors. And this blew my mind. I was like, what? You could like make this a career? What? This is so ridiculous.
That idea that you can be a professional YouTuber and a content creator starts to emerge as a real thing in the world. And that Social Blue Book website is the revelation that changes everything for Adam. And this awakening happens almost at a perfect time when Adam isn't super busy yet with performance work. He's still fairly new to New York as a working musician, and like all of us at that point, he's a little lost, searching everywhere for gigs to fill up his daily schedule. In that early time as a new musician, it's hard to be really creative. Your only concern is trying to make music work as a viable career option.
Sometimes I would be getting gigs. Some of them were okay. Some of them were less than great. I was doing a lot of weddings. That was kind of at the same time I joined a wedding band and started like having a little bit more of a working musician's career. But I was feeling a little listless at that point in 2015, where I didn't really know where or what I wanted to do because everything wasn't clicking the way that it was supposed to. You know, I didn't really have an artistic project at the time to speak of. I guess Sungazer technically existed back then, but we weren't doing anything with that. Like, we played one gig in 2015, and then we didn't think that it would turn into anything. So I'm like, all right, well, I got to focus some of my creative energy somewhere, and I might get paid for it. That would be amazing.
So in search of an outlet for his creative energy, he turns his attention to his YouTube channel, which at this point has 5,000 subscribers, which even today is a sizable YouTube channel. That's 5,000 people who have individually clicked on a subscribe button. But in 2015, that number was even more impressive. Leaving aside the viral music trends, the first thing Adam does is take a look at what non-music channels he's a fan of. Just things he watches in his free time when he's not making his own videos.
At the time, I was a fan of a couple of science education and media education YouTube channels. There's SciShow, there is Vsauce, and there's, of course, PBS Idea Channel.
The terrifying nature of face swaps gives us insight into what it's like to be a computer.
These were all channels that posted weekly, and I loved their format of like communicating science and communicating a variety of different things via YouTube videos. And they were very fun and very exciting and digestible, but sometimes they engage with very deep and interesting and meaningful questions. And I thought, well, this is great. Like, I love this stuff. I want to engage on a deeper level with a lot of the musical and historical and musicological and philosophical ideas I've been thinking about my whole life. Might as well just like try and do that, what they're doing. But then, you know, I can do it for me and my channel.
So he begins to almost transcribe these formats, like any musician would transcribe a cool bass line or an awesome solo, except it's video production. But what he doesn't see is what's happening behind the scenes of the channels he's drawing inspiration from.
But all of those channels had teams that would work on these videos. It wasn't just the person in front of the camera. Vsauce, for example, was funded by Google. PBS Idea Channel was funded by PBS. And while Mike Rugnetta, who is the amazing host of PBS Idea Channel, would write all the scripts and be the presenter, somebody was editing the video, somebody was doing all the animation and all that. But I didn't know that at the time. I was just like, I'm going to learn how to do that. So I resolved I would post once a week and I would learn how to use Final Cut to do all of those fancy animations.
And so was born the channel that we all know today with this video titled Bass Muting Technique, Adam Neely's Bass Lesson Video Number 1.
Now, for other instruments, especially ones like sitar, where it's actually part of the design, this actually will sound really nice. But for bass guitar, it sounds like utter crap. So part of your job as a bass player is to shut the bass the hell up.
July of 2015 is when Adam vows that he's going to post every week, no matter what. And you can see that level of dedication on his channel. In the two previous years, he posted around 12 videos each year, which is still one video every month, which is a lot. But starting 2015, he posts 57 videos that year.
The idea was, no matter what, every Monday I'm going to release something. And that was for several reasons. One, it was to keep me honest. There's nothing quite like a deadline, even if it's a self-imposed deadline, to make sure that you are working and focused. And it really focuses you in on the whole process. Like, what is the idea? How do you write a script? How do you execute the script?
And that sounds fairly straightforward when you break it down into three neat steps. But each of those steps is hours of planning, script writing, production, filming, mixing, post-production, and so much more that goes into just one single video. Like so many musicians, his creative passion project consisted of hours that would be similar to a very busy full-time day job. But he wasn't making money from any of this work yet.
I always had AdSense on throughout this whole process. I was never really making much money through it, but it was nice occasionally to receive the minimum threshold, which is $100. Like maybe every year and a half, I would receive $100 in the mail.
He's just doing it, again, because he feels compelled to, in the hopes that this will one day become his job, while he continues his actual job of being a freelance bass player in the city. So each week, he starts thinking and researching a new topic and working on the script. On Friday and Saturday, he shoots the video. And for the rest of the weekend, he's editing it all together so that it's up on YouTube on Monday.
Having the weekly schedule also keeps people engaged weekly, hopefully, if you've developed an audience so far. It also teaches you process of being able to start something and finish something and repeat that process. And through that, you get better at all of the nitty-gritty, like the editing, the filming, the whatever. And I think for everybody, that's a very useful lesson to learn because it teaches you, one, not to be precious, meaning if something's good enough, just do it because there's other things that need to be done. And it's more about the process of starting and finishing rather than getting something right.
And if you're listening and you're someone who makes things, you know the struggle of getting it right that Adam is talking about. I wouldn't say all artists are perfectionists by nature, but there is this idea that things can only be released until they're flawless. And we put so much emphasis on the final product, forgetting about the larger arc of the entire process. And for me personally, it's about learning to understand that it's not exactly my job to fall in love with my own final product. My job is to make things to the best of my abilities and release them. It's someone else's job. It's your job, in fact, right now, listening to this episode, to either love it or not, which, you know, I hope you do.
The process of starting and finishing is very important and something that was very important for me personally because it got me out of the rut of like, oh, I want to release this music, but it's not good enough. It's not good enough. And then getting very frustrated. If you're on a weekly schedule, There's no time to get frustrated. You got to get something out by Monday.
Now, you can make the argument that maybe getting frustrated is a part of the necessary quality control, which is important. It's not your job to love what you make, but you do need to make things that are good. At least good to you at the time. But we'll never make something that we unequivocally think is good forever. Because as you grow and practice and get better at your craft also gets better. And the things you once made will no longer seem amazing. But that's a natural part of growth. Cringing at old things you make is just a part of the process.
I mean, it's bad, but it's like, it's fine. I don't cringe necessarily. Well, like, I do cringe a little bit. But it's through the process of doing that over and over again and developing my own language that I am where I am today. It was literally 5 years of doing it every Monday.
In October 2016, after over a year of posting every single week, the goal that Adam had in 2014 of doing something that goes viral finally happens. But it doesn't happen because he jumps on a trend or synthesizes some viral moment. He goes viral on his terms, making just another weekly video about yet another topic he had been thinking about. The video is called How and Why Classical Musicians Feel Rhythm Differently.
The way that classical musicians feel rhythm can be very different from the way that rhythm is felt by musicians who play jazz, rock, or pop music, or really any music from the past 100 years that has its origins in West Africa.
And I remember driving with him to a wedding gig that summer where he mentioned in the car that he was seeing an unusual amount of traffic on that video.
Well, it was so strange because I released the video in January of 2016, and it went viral in October of 2016. Yeah, it was a very strange disconnect there. There's a fundamental way that rhythm section players especially, and then also people who play in, jazz and rock and funk and R&B, there's a fundamental divide between how rhythm section players play time and how string players play time in an orchestra. There's a difference in understanding where the beat begins in terms of how the transients interact with one another. And it's because rhythm section players have to contend very deeply with the drum set in a way that string players just do not have to contend with. It's a very interesting thing, and it relates to the physics of the instrument and also the style of how time is felt historically.
And Adam's video explains everything he just said about how time is felt differently, both stylistically and acoustically. But like anything that goes viral, this video got a pretty sharp and polarizing reaction. And not really because of the content, but maybe more his tone than anything else.
I made the video with kind of a smarmy attitude, and that I think is what a lot of people reacted to, reacting kind of negatively to it. But I stand by it. It's interesting that that is the thing that kind of brought me on the map to a general audience, is this particularly specific way of rhythm being interpreted differently, but people were upset that I was being smarmy about it. And I might make the video differently now, but I stand behind it.
And that's another lesson in consistency that I take away from Adam's experience with virality. I'm sure it fazed him. How could it not? But it didn't stop him either from continuing to make videos and continuing to grow in the direction that he wanted to. And it even led to Adam launching his Patreon, which at the time had just come out.
The virality of that video was the thing that made me start the Patreon. Since I had been a fan of Pomplamoose and Jack Conti and Natalie Dawn for so long, I knew of Patreon, and I signed up for Patreon the day it launched. I just never did anything with it. But by the time I had a little bit of viral success, I knew that it was time to actually start it and launch it and get people excited about it. And that's kind of the process. Yeah, I started with Patreon, and then that was how I funded and started within maybe a year or so. I was living primarily through Patreon, which was amazing, amazing.
Now it's 2022. And since that first viral video, Adam has released 307 more videos over the span of 6 years. That's consistency. And the crazy part about it is that they're all really good videos. I'm not sure he thinks so, and it's not really his job to think so. It's ours, and I think I can speak for many people when I say they are really good videos. Adam's now at a point where he has two careers, his music career and his YouTube career. They're not exactly two sides of the same coin. They're more like the same side of two different coins. They're both made from the same creative energy. They're both equally a part of him, but they're distinctly separate things.
I definitely think of YouTube as the business side of things, whereas I think of music as the creative side of things. But at the same time, there's a creative aspect to YouTube, and there's definitely a business aspect to music. And they inform each other, but it's sometimes difficult to make them meet as one specific thing, because YouTube requires a very specific way of engaging people. YouTube, you need to think about titles, you need to think about thumbnails, you need to think about compelling stories, you need to think about compelling subjects. And if you're catering your music to that, you feel so constrained. You feel like you can't express things that won't be algorithmically engaging. So you have to think about, like, all right, how do I talk about my own personal music in a compelling and interesting way and tell compelling and interesting stories for YouTube? And sometimes that isn't possible because the title won't be good for YouTube, or the story won't be engaging for YouTube, even if the music is very cool and very exciting and very good.
And I've had a little taste of that myself with this podcast, where I've really enjoyed creating episodes based off of my own music. But I also really love talking about other people, just like this episode. Finding that balance between the different sides of what gives you purpose can be pretty tricky. Switching between one thing to the other isn't like switching between two tasks on a to-do list. When you're consumed in a project, you dedicate your whole self into it. Taking that self out and dropping it into something else can kind of feel like getting into a cold swimming pool or something. You can't jump in right away. You need to ease into it all over again, one foot at a time.
To borrow a term from Persig, the author of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, it's about gumption. How much energy you have to dedicate to a project. And the problem with YouTube and something like a podcast is that it saps gumption from your musical career, meaning you just don't have the headspace. There's no, like, you physically can do things for sure. You can go through the motions of things, but you don't have that underlying fire that connects everything together into one unified whole. Music requires a lot of underlying fire, a lot of underlying energy to create something that you feel proud of and you feel is worthwhile and necessary. And it's the same thing with YouTube and something like a podcast. It requires a lot of detail-oriented thought.
So where does that leave us if we want to do multiple things together, like so many musicians do? What if you're a performer but also a songwriter? Or what if you're a mix engineer, but you also really love music journalism and writing about new albums?
There's a story I've heard of, like, somebody asking Benny Golson, what do you focus more on, playing or composing? You do both so well, like, what should I spend my time on? And he basically just said, yeah, I just go back and forth between the two of them. Like, you can't really do both of them at the same time. You just have to, like, spend some time doing one, and then some time doing another, and then go back to the other, and then go back to the other. Like, there's no secret formula. It's just you're doing one thing, you spend some time on that, and then you do another thing, and you spend some time on that.
And that back and forth swing like a pendulum is kind of a good thing in the long run, because you're coming back to the previous thing with a fresh new perspective each time.
By focusing on one and exhausting yourself on one, it's rejuvenating to switch to the other. When I'm in YouTube mode and I'm just, like, so engaged in, like, creating, like, a big, you know, 30-minute video essay or whatever, spend so much time, it's exhausting, and then I finally release it, and then I'm like, I kind of want to make some music, and then I focus on music, you know, for a week or two. And then it gives me the ability to go back to YouTube after that. And that, like, crop rotation of focusing on different crops to plant on your land season after season, so the land doesn't get completely sucked of all the nutrients from planting the same crop over and over again. I think about creative aspects like that all the time. YouTube is one crop, music is another crop. Maybe YouTube's like strawberries, and then music's like wheat or something. I don't know. I don't know anything about farming.
So Adam might not know a ton about farming, but he does know a lot about music and YouTube, especially his experience doing both of those things at a very high level. Musicians love to plague themselves with finding the right path, the correct way, and the secret method of becoming successful. And if you watch enough interviews or listen to enough advice, maybe you'll find that secret nugget that all successful people have in common, and then you'll unlock the realm of successful person. I'm saying you, but what I really mean is me. I'm mostly speaking to myself here. If you ask Adam what he thinks about his career so far, he'll tell you that it's a combination of everything.
So I was extraordinarily lucky. At the same time, I worked very hard and was very smart about decisions that I made and really understood the platform. And also at the top of that, I was, what do they call it in the tech space, a first adopter. Like, I was a first adopter of YouTube. I have an advantage that nobody will ever have on YouTube, in that I was there from the very beginning. Just understanding where I am right now, you have to take those three things into consideration. I was a first adopter. I was extraordinarily lucky. And then I also worked my ass off for many, many years, et cetera, which is something that I don't like emphasizing because it creates a toxic grind culture for so many people. But that all was really on the back of just good timing, good luck. There's other things, there's demographic reasons why I've had success, and that, you know, algorithmically certain social pressures and certain social norms are reinforced. So like male looking guy who is talking authoritatively to you via a camera about music is like a thing that YouTube naturally will promote and naturally will recommend to people. So in that way, I'm also privileged in addition to being lucky, in addition to being like a first adopter. So I'm not sure what you can take, what lessons you can take from that. I guess the lessons to take are be a first adopter of something cool, work your ass off, and hope against hope that you get lucky. There are many other people like me who don't have a platform like I do. So what I'm saying is, like, take everything I say and everything anybody who is successful says with a grain of salt, because survivor bias is a big thing also.
And it's true. We can never predict what is going to work the way we expect it to or not. Luck and timing and algorithms are real, but they're also beyond our control. The only thing that is in our control is how we choose to spend our time. And the lesson I take away from this is that it's all about consistency. Not about grinding yourself down or doing anything that'll cause irreversible harm, but just about keeping the faith. If you have something you cherish, hold on to it and keep doing it. As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode, and thank you so much to my patrons over at Patreon who support the show. I love making music, and I love making podcasts, and if you like any of the things I'm releasing, come join my awesome community over at Patreon. For a few bucks a month, you get access to a bunch of exclusive content, early access to videos, backing tracks, sheet music, but most importantly, you give me a reason to keep doing this every day. So thank you for that, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.